It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here as we look at the spread of a protest movement in Iran and what these demonstrations mean after the death of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini last month, not fully covering her hair with a hijab as mandated by the country's so-called morality police. We explore why her death has struck a nerve in Iran, what may happen in the future after these demonstrations. 800-642-1234. Roya Hakakian is an author and poet who fled her country of Iran in 1984. Roya, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, wearing a headscarf became law, as you are well aware, in 1983 in the theocratic regime. What effects has this dress code have had on women's lives?
Well, as you can imagine, being a woman, we all, being human beings, we all want to choose how we dress. It's the most important expression of our selfhoods. We tell the world who we are through what we wear. And imagine someone else, some other ruler telling you how it is that you can actually appear, which in the case of Iran is you become sort of a faceless person in a sea of other people. But it is not simply a matter of stripping someone of the ability to express themselves. It's also a symbol of subjugation. When women are forced under the hijab, they are forced to be faceless, shapeless. And as a result, the position that's socially imposed upon women, which is the position of a second-class citizen, sinks in much more easily along with the way women appear in public. So it has been one of the worst things that has happened to Iranian women, if not the worst, since 1979. And I'm not surprised that this generation can no longer tolerate it.
As you watch the images coming out of your homeland, I'm wondering what goes through your mind as you see women taking off their headscarves, you know, twirling them above their heads, cutting their hair. What do you make of these images?
It's truly amazing. I am not surprised on one hand, because when I was 17 and 18 and I was forced under the hijab in Iran, I felt angry enough to do the very same things. So I'm not surprised. But I'm also awed, because I don't think I would ever dare to do what these women are doing. The amount of fearlessness, the amount of courage that they're showing to come out in public, young girls, you know, 16, 17, and to do what they're doing in the face of armed men, riot police, you know, these institutions that have thus far struck fear in the hearts of Iranian people, no longer work. And I think that is the most amazing development I have seen in the past 40 years. And I really bow my head to all these women and men who are out on the streets fighting.
When you were a young person, a teenager in Iran, what was it like to be questioned by the morality police? Were you ever questioned?
All the time. Mm. All the time. You know, Mahsa Amini, the girl who was detained by the morality police and then died in the custody of the morality police, was an entirely ordinary person. In various reports that we have read about her, we read, and it's been reported that she wasn't covering her hair. I know through a reporter who's been in touch with her family that no, that was not the case. Her hair was covered with the scarf. It was the fact that the bottom two buttons of her Islamic uniform were open. And that's what they picked on. So, you know, this is to say that when I was, when I was a teenager, as you can see from the case of Mahsa, you don't have to do very much to be questioned and to be detained. And it is very terrifying. And it makes life quite miserable. And it isn't simply that you're necessarily doing something wrong. It's also that, you know, if they put morality police on the street, they have to, you know, deliver a statement to the public that's passing by. And so every once in a while, they have to make an example of somebody, you know, pick on a person, detain them, question them, take them away. And it just makes life, ordinary life that ought to be without these unnecessary fears, entirely terrifying.
If you're just joining us, we're discussing the uprisings in Iran with poet and journalist Roya Hekakian. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Roya, why did you leave Iran?
Well, I had graduated high school. Mm-hmm. The war between Iran and Iraq was at a peak. It was in its fourth year. In 1984. And the future was very bleak. You know, it didn't look like the war was going to end. Iran was under sanctions by the entire, by the entire Western world. We were hearing red sirens to go hunker down in shelters on a daily basis. And I'm also Jewish, and therefore, I had several strikes against me. I was a woman, I was a Jew, and in a country that was at war. So it didn't look like staying there was going to, in any way, shape, or form, give me or my family a bright future. So we decided to leave. And part of what you hear from these young demonstrators on the streets is that if they don't come out to the streets and overthrow the regime and change this system, they too have no future. And this is as much a struggle for their present as it is for them to make a better future possible for themselves.
What seems to be remarkable is how conservative and liberal Iranians have seemed to come together in this moment. What do you notice there?
It is quite exciting because in every possible realm, I have observed this solidarity that I haven't seen in the past 40 years. Even in the silly social media, I see people being very supportive of each other, retweeting each other's messages, giving each other encouragement. And then within the country, it's been astounding. For years and years, we have heard from the regime and from people who support the regime that, Iran will be separated and fall apart because there are all these ethnic minorities who believe in this separatist agenda. And, the Kurds want to go start their own nation and their own country. And, the Baluchis and the Azeris and all these other, ethnicities want to go off and start their own countries. And so if this bad regime were to go, everything would fall apart. And so, by instilling that fear, they have basically silenced people and cowed them into submission. What's been amazing in the past 4 weeks is that all of these ethnicities, all of these groups who we had been told to fear because mm-hmm. they wanted to separate from the rest of the country, have come together. You hear chants in support of the Kurds in the streets of Azerbaijan, you hear chants in support of the Azeris in the heart of the Balochistan. So it has been an astounding demonstration of universal support and solidarity within the country, of the kind that I only remember from my childhood in 1978 and 1979 during, you know, the revolution. The original revolution.
Mm-hmm. Iranian-American poet and author Roya Hakakian with us on her perspective of the unrest unfolding in Iran, what it means for the future of the Islamic regime, its morality police. Her recent article in The Atlantic is called The Bonfire of the Headscarves. Join in 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. More women are risking their lives on the streets of Iran. We explore the fight for women's freedoms, especially after the death of Mahsa Amini last month. Videos coming out of Iran on social media of these protests show women waving their headscarves above their heads in solidarity. We have Roya Hakakian, who is an author and poet. Her latest book is called A Beginner's Guide to America, and she stays with us. Roya, let's turn to Western nations. In your column in The Atlantic, you argue that Iranians will not be able to win their freedom without support from Western nations. What would you like to see the U.S. do to help?
Well, first of all, let's kind of look at, you know, the trend of revolutions we've seen throughout the world in the past 10, 20 years. I cannot recall, with the exception of perhaps one or two examples, any one of them succeeding on their own, especially against a heavily armed and historically brutal military apparatus without the support of the international community. So there is only so much that an unarmed nation can do against a very heavily armed adversary, such as, you know, the regime in Iran at the moment. So we have to kind of think, as Americans, as Westerners who believe in democratic values, as feminists who must see this struggle as a continuation of women's struggle everywhere in the world, which began almost 100 years ago, going on in Iran, unfolding at the moment. And so if our sisterhood is global, in fact, and if we believe that one struggle it supports the next struggle for freedom, for egalitarian values, then we must do everything we can to support democratic activists, to support the sentiment for freedom, liberty, and egalitarian values in Iran. In the same way that we decided that the struggle in Ukraine, the fight that the Ukrainians are waging against the Russians, is ultimately a fight for democracy for the rest of the world too. So I think we ought to do everything we can. So, you know, Iranians lose internet all the time. The regime shuts down the internet, and it's terrifying because obviously when the news doesn't come out of Iran, it often means that the riot police, the military forces are out on the streets killing people. So if we want to bring in a small measure of safety, at least we have to make sure that people stay connected to the rest of us. I think placing all the people who are carrying out these violent activities on the streets on a list of sanctions is pretty important. We have done that as in the past couple of weeks. The State Department added several names to the list of sanctions. I think, you know, other Western European nations, who have embassies in Iran should cut diplomatic ties when they see 16 and 17 year olds coming out on the streets unarmed and being shot to death. So there's a whole lot we can do.
Very quickly, because we're almost out of time, but if the Iranian government is overturned or reformed, what do you hope will replace it?
I am not sure. I think there are, I don't think anybody knows, but I think there will be hopefully a referendum in the same way that there was a referendum in 1979. And people would choose which form of government they wish to have. You know, in 1979, there was a question on the ballot. Do you wish to have the Islamic Republic or no? And people chose an Islamic Republic. And it seems very much that people no longer want to mix religion with the affairs of the state, that they want a separation of the two institutions. And I think we start with a referendum and take it from there.
Roya, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Roya Hekakian is a journalist and poet. Her latest book is called A Beginner's Guide to America for the Immigrant and the Curious. Now, Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes sailed through the Democratic primary in Wisconsin's U.S. Senate race, thanks in part to his progressive record and prominent liberal endorsements. But the very things that made him a favorite among the Democratic base have been attacked as liabilities in his campaign against Republican U.S. Senator Ron Johnson. Rich Kramer reports.
On a rural St. Croix County farm in mid-September, a small crowd of Democrats have come to rally behind Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes. Minnesota U.S. Senator Amy Klobuchar is the featured speaker. She praises Barnes and says he would compliment Wisconsin's other senator, Democrat Tammy Baldwin.
And in my mind, you shouldn't have one incredible, awesome, respected U.S. senator out of the state of Wisconsin. You should have two.
Barnes won the Democratic primary for Senate with endorsements from progressive icons like U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. Klobuchar is a different kind of Democrat. She's run as a moderate, and at this rally, she's appealing to a different kind of voter.
And you tell your friends, whether they are independents, moderate Republicans in this district, a district that has supported Democrats in the past, you tell them our very democracy is on the line.
But in a hyper-competitive state like Wisconsin, that's easier said than done. Since the primary, Barnes has been hit with a wave of Republican attack ads describing him as a radical liberal. And they appear to have made a mark.
The Republicans are putting on a clinic right now.
That's UW La Crosse political science professor Anthony Chergosky.
They are putting on a case study in how to run an effective negative campaign against an opponent.
The main attacks against Barnes have portrayed him as soft on crime.
Do you feel safe? Mandela Barnes would eliminate cash bail.
Some show video of him suggesting funding from law enforcement can be shifted to pay for social services. Others highlight his calls 4 years ago to cut the prison population in half. Republicans have amplified their message with money. An analysis by the watchdog group Open Secrets shows that between the candidates and outside groups, Republicans have outspent Democrats by roughly $20 million. Democratic strategist Joe Zepecki says despite that, it's still a close race between Johnson and Barnes. He says Democrats at the national level should take notice.
In the 11 elections statewide since Donald Trump won in 2016, the Democratic candidate or the Democratic-backed candidate has won 10 of them. 10 of 11. We know how to win here, but we need the resources to do it.
This month, the Barnes campaign is trying to shift voters' focus back to Ron Johnson. They've run ads highlighting Johnson's long anti-abortion record.
But it's Johnson's views that are alarming. Johnson supported a ban on abortions.
And Barnes has taken that message on the road. During a stop last week at an Eau Claire cafe, Barnes met with a group of women to talk about the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling that struck down Roe v. Wade. He says Johnson's past votes for a national abortion ban are too extreme for Wisconsin.
The reality is Ron Johnson is just not there for us, and he is not the person to be trusted when it comes to women's health.
The UW La Crosse's Chergosky says the counterattack could mean the race hinges on a sliver of independent voters. He says they'll have to decide whether they see Barnes as a candidate who has said things about public safety that make them uncomfortable, or whether they see Johnson as a candidate out of step with the public on abortion. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And WPR's profile of U.S. Senator Ron Johnson aired yesterday. You can find both stories at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.